the China, never met her before. Who cares when you drop kicked your jacket as you came through the door? No one glares, but sometimes things get turned around and no one's spared. All hands look out below. There's a change in the status quo.
This is S5, E6 of Fanacek. I am back. It's been a couple weeks. I'm continuing on this season 5 journey of exploring 80s film and television. You know, I just did that big series on Teen Wolf about recasting Boof. Now I'm doing something different. The next couple of episodes, we're going to be taking a look at some classic 80s sitcoms through the lens of their housekeeper. So the next couple episodes, I'll focus on shows that had crazy housekeeping, good housekeeping, some shows that needed a housekeeper that didn't. But this is Keeping House Part 1, and I hope you enjoy it. So housekeepers as surrogate parents and or, you know, like wise, sagely family members, they've been a staple of television shows since like the early days, right? I mean, Hazel is a great example, premiered in 1961. Hazel lasted 154 episodes and told the story of the Baxter family. Husband George, wife Dorothy, they had a young son named Harold. Although George and Dorothy were seemingly very capable adults, they relied heavily on their housekeeper Hazel to run the household. In fact, Hazel was often in charge, right? And George was often exasperated, I will. And comedy always ensued. Almost a decade later, Alice served the same function for our favorite blended family, right? The Brady Bunch. So you had Mike Brady, like George Baxter, worked a full-time job. Carol Brady, like Dorothy Baxter, did not yet. Like the Baxters, the Bradys relied on Alice for all of the cooking, the cleaning, the zaniness, right? So don't get me wrong, six kids are a lot for old Carol to handle, I get it. But they weren't school at this point. It's not like she was up to her eyes in dirty diapers and toddler toys, right? Carol could have gotten off her ass and cleaned some shit. Growing up on 80s television, enjoying reruns from decades past, I just accepted that housekeepers and housekeeping in general was just something that some families had while others didn't. Mine was one of the ones that didn't. Growing up poor, a housekeeper was, gosh, about as likely as a Ferrari and a Handy from Lonnie Anderson, right? Years later, though, as a husband and father, I proudly moved my family up into upper middle class, I think. Nice house, got the 3-car garage. I have like 56 streaming services, the works. I was shocked when my work-from-home wife requested we hire help to clean the house. I mean, surely we were not going to be one of those families that paid someone else to clean their home. So I firmly put my foot down for about a day or two until I realized I wasn't going to win this battle. So reluctantly, we hired a housekeeper, and it was a revelation. Once again, television had been an imperfect teacher because its representation of housekeeping versus what it actually is are worlds apart. Here's what I learned. First, having a housekeeper is crazy expensive. I spend about $600 a month to have someone come like every 2 weeks and clean my entire house, right? I can't imagine what it would cost to have them actually live with me and cook the meals and do all that other shit. Second, they don't raise my children. They don't teach them lessons or help with their homework or meddle in their love lives. In fact, they've never even been alone with my children. So that's another thing that's different. And third, cleaning a big house yourself takes forever and it sucks. Remember I pushed back on my wife when she wanted to hire help? And although I relented, I still felt like I was throwing my money away, quite frankly, paying someone to do something that we were clearly capable of doing ourselves until COVID, when we actually did have to do it ourselves. And man, it fucking sucked. I remember I spent about 3 hours deep cleaning our master bathroom. 3 hours, just the bathroom. What the fuck? Let's hire 10 people. I'm never doing this again. So I came around on that. So it all informed me that the lessons I learned on TV were bullshit. So as I think of these lessons learned, I can't help but ponder some of the housekeeping situations I witnessed on some of my favorite 80s TV shows. Some of these families needed the housekeepers they had and could afford them as well. Some didn't need them and likely couldn't have afforded them anyway. And some houses were remarkably full of people with perfectly clean homes, yet no housekeeper in sight. We were taught wrong. It's a mess, but it's a mess that I intend to clean. Get it? Because of housekeeping, I'm going to clean this mess up. Let's examine the roles of housekeepers and lack thereof in some of our favorite 80s TV shows. Which families made sense having a full-time housekeeper? Which housekeepers took too many liberties? Which parents seemingly delegated all their parenting duties to the housekeepers? And which families needed a housekeeper because the house was too damn big and always too fucking clean? Like, how did it get that clean? I call it bullshit. I want to identify the good, the bad, and the what the fuck. So grab your Swiffer and follow me. The first show we're going to talk about, one of the craziest shows of all time, Different Strokes. This show deserves its own book, quite frankly. It's hard to ignore the cast's tragic legacy, right, of Different Stroke, Gary Coleman and Dana Plato's sad lives, untimely deaths, plus Todd Bridges and his years of drug addiction and connection to murder. It makes you wonder what the hell was going on in that set, quite frankly, for all these people's lives to go so downhill. It was also a revolving door of amazing guest stars. I mean, Nancy Reagan, Mr. T, David Hasselhoff and Kit, Andrew Dice Clay, Janet Jackson, Dabney Coleman, Dick Sargent, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, and many others. Let's not forget also Gordon Jump's amazing two-part episode, which we'll talk about. He played the pedophile bicycle shop owner. He took Dudley's shirt off and gave him wine. I mean, holy shit. Different Strokes had arguably some of the craziest special episodes. It also had arguably the catchiest theme song ever. And then it gave birth to The Facts of Life and its equally catchy theme song. I mean, this show is going to live on forever, even if only in infamy. Now, Different Strokes premiered on November 3rd, 1978. It's a story, and we all know it. It's a story of a single rich man who promises to adopt the two sons of his dying housekeeper after she passes away. It was originally intended to be a vehicle for Conrad Bain. He had just come off a successful run on Maude, and NBC promised him his own show. Meanwhile, though, NBC also had a deal with newcomer Gary Coleman. They initially intended to use him in a reboot of the Our Gang series, but when that failed to launch, they kind of paired them both up. We'll take Conrad Bain, we'll take Gary Coleman, and the rest is history. So unfortunately, though, for Conrad Bain, this was never his show. Gary Coleman was quickly the breakout star, and everyone else was basically set dressing at that point. Starting with the pilot, this show was shit. It was crap. The writing was weak. The acting was questionable, but Gary Coleman was a star, and the premise of two poor, you know, black brothers being adopted by a rich white man honestly was pretty intriguing. So it became a hit and lasted 181 episodes over 8 seasons. Now, I've recently rewatched a few episodes, and the only things that hold up are Gary Coleman in the early episodes and that damn theme song. Everything else sucks. Now, alas, I don't have time to write a whole book just about Different Strokes yet. Anyway, I'll get to it. But I do have time to talk about the role that housekeepers played, because this show featured not one, not two, but three full-time live-in housekeepers. It made sense that Philip Drummond would have a full-time housekeeper. He's a widowed millionaire, father of three, and that's why I put this show kind of in the good category. But there's still some things to poke fun at. So let's take a look at each of the housekeepers. So in seasons one and two, the housekeeper was Charlotte Ray. She played Miss Edna Garrett. Now, Miss Garrett is the original and best of the three Different Strokes housekeepers. She was short with big red, almost beehive style hairdo. Her voice was super shrill and her head always seemed to be kind of shaking when she spoke. Hello, Arnold. Hello, Mr. Drummond. She just kind of came off as crazy. She was basically a cartoon character. Or better yet, like a redheaded bobblehead doll. That's who she was. Mrs. Garrett often practices cultural appropriation, too, by engaging Arnold and Willis in jive handshakes, especially early on. So we're supposed to believe that, like, this crazy old lady is down with the streets, you know, with her jive and all that shit. Is what it is. Edna Garrett proved to be very valuable to the network because she was the bridge for Different Strokes, its second spinoff, The Facts of Life. Different Strokes' first spinoff was a vehicle created for McLean Stevenson, that only lasted 38 episodes from 1979 to 80. I'm not sure. 79 to 80, maybe. It was called Hello Larry. Let's do a quick Hello Larry tangent. McLean Stevenson basically had been bouncing around since he left MASH in 1975. He eventually landed this crappy fucking show, which initially wasn't even supposed to be a spinoff of Different Strokes. It was produced by the same company. And then after several months of shitty ratings, they thought they could boost its appeal anyway by linking it to the Gary Coleman money train that we call Different Strokes. The Different Strokes folks appear in episode 10, and we learn that Larry is an old war buddy of Philip Drummond. Apparently, they served in Korea together, but not in MASH, because that would be weird. But not in the MASH unit, right? Are we really supposed to believe, though, that Philip Drummond, arguably the least threatening man in television history, served in the military? And in a war, no less? I'm not having it, man. That guy is fucking weak with his dicky and everything. Anyway, the cast also included Kim Richards, who, along with her sisters Kathy and Kyle, would later appear as drunken lunatics on The Real Housewives of Beverly Hills. So there you go. Interestingly, Lisa Welchel auditioned for Kim Richards' role but didn't get it. And it goes to show you that sometimes it's best to not get what you want, because later that year, Lisa would land the far better role of Blair on the far better Different Strokes spinoff, The Facts of Life. And that, my friends, is a segue back to The Facts of Life. Mrs. Garrett left the Drummond household to be a house mother at the Eastland School for Girls. That's how Facts of Life starts. Season one featured a really large cast, mostly took place in the dormitory. The show was completely retooled for season two, and most of the cast was released. They kept three girls, they added Nancy McKeon, and they created this weird storyline that I talked about in the Booth stuff, where the four girls were essentially forced to live in the kitchen with Mrs. Garrett serving as their warden. I don't know. Mr. Drummond would visit every now and then, and Kim Fields would sometimes appear on Different Strokes if he's a Kimberly, which is another segue back to Different Strokes. So with Miss Garrett off molding the young women of Eastland, the Drummond housekeeping duties then went to the character of Adelaide. She was played by Nedra Voles. Nedra joined the cast about halfway through season two. Adelaide had by far the least to do of the three housekeepers. In fact, I have hardly any memory of her beyond the fact that I thought she was a dead ringer for Tweety Bird's owner, Granny. If you go back and look at the Tweety Bird cartoons, she has this owner named Granny, and Nedra Voles looked just like her. Nedra didn't start working in film and television until 1973 when she was 65 years old, right? And she would end up with 65 credits and appeared in tons of classic TV shows like, let's see, Good Times, Rhoda, Maude, All in the Family, WKRP in Cincinnati, Alice, The A-Team, tons others, right? Not too shabby for someone who didn't even start till she was 65. Now, in season five, Mary Jo Catlett joined the cast as the third and final housekeeper, Pearl Gallagher. Pearl was like a no-nonsense housekeeper. Her resume was like supposedly very impressive. It included several secretaries of state. No one knows why she decided to slum it with the Drummonds, but I'm guessing she thought a family of four would be a walk in the park. Little did she know that Philip would soon remarry to a woman named Maggie, originally played by Dixie Carter, who was replaced with Mary Ann Mobley for you nerds. Maggie was a package deal because she came with an annoying son named Sam, played by Danny Cooksey. We've all seen this before. It's called The Cousin Oliver, right? When the young cute kid in a show is no longer young and cute, the show will often bring in a reinforcement in the form of a new young cute kid. This time it was country singing redhead Sam. I'm guessing Pearl, like me, wanted to jump out the fucking window every time this little fucker opened his mouth. Fortunately, she didn't jump, and she remained the Drummond housekeeper until the final episode on March 7th, 1986. Here's a fun little tidbit about the housekeepers. They all appeared in one Different Strokes episode, all of them at the same time. It was titled The Wedding. It's season 6, episode 18. And you guessed it, it's about a wedding. In fact, it's Mr. Drummond's wedding to Maggie. Apparently, there's a deleted scene in which Mrs. Garrett, Adelaide, and Pearl all get in the hot tub together. I'm in there with them. And FYI, I sometimes struggle with deciphering reality from fantasy, but I think I hot tubbed with all three of them. I think I did. Anyway, so let's break down, though, the portrayal of the housekeepers on Different Strokes. Let's break it down. Did it make sense that the Drummonds had a full-time live-in housekeeper? You bet. He's rich and single. Did the housekeepers take too many liberties? Maybe. But they were also forced to live with Arnold Drummond, who couldn't go more than 42 seconds without making a look how funny I am wise-ass fucking comment. Were they surrogate parents? No. I'd say no. They stayed in their lane. They didn't get too far into the parenting game. Did they do a good job? Yeah. They seem to always be dusting shit. The meals look good. The house is always clean. So final grade, I'm going to give these housekeepers an A. Well done to you, Edna, Adelaide, and Pearl. And thank you for that night of loving in the hot tub. I will never, ever forget it, if in fact it happened. So a few more thoughts on Different Strokes. As I said earlier, this show was awful. But one thing it did well was to not give a shit about Jumping the Shark or having very special episodes, and especially Jumping the Shark during very special episodes. So here are some of my favorite batshit crazy episodes of Different Strokes. Season 1, Episode 8, Retrospective. This was a clip show where the family is reminiscing about all of the zany moments they've shared since Arnold and Willis joined the family. This was a common trope in the 80s, basically an excuse not to write a new episode and just use clips from previous episodes. There's nothing special about this, except for the fact that this was only their 8th episode. How are you doing a greatest hits clip show having only 7 episodes under your belt? Either they were really fucking proud of those first 7 episodes, or that writer's room was plumb out of ideas. In case you can't tell, I am shaking my head disapprovingly. Okay, now, the next episode I want to discuss, Season 3, Episode 1, The Bank Job. Arnold and Willis become hostages during a bank robbery by 2 experienced criminals. The robbers soon realize that Mr. Drummond is a millionaire and use hostages Arnold and Willis as bargaining chips. Mr. Drummond, wearing his dickie, decides to be a tough guy to save his sons, which is a laugh. Meanwhile, even being held hostage during a robbery doesn't slow down Arnold's dumb fucking wisecracks, and the robbers eventually shot him. Or did I dream that last part too? Was that like the hot tub that I dreamed that? Or did the robbers shoot Arnold? I don't know. But in any event, hostages in a bank robbery. Okay, Season 3, Episode 8, Count Your Blessings. When Arnold learns that he will only grow to be 5 feet tall, he becomes very upset. To make him feel better, Mr. Drummond introduces him to a friend's daughter who is very upbeat despite being confined to a wheelchair. Let me be more specific. Arnold is bummed about being short. Mr. Drummond thinks he'll feel better when comparing himself to someone who is 3 feet tall living with osteogenesis imperfecta, which is an incurable condition which leaves you with very brittle bones. So, wow. I hope you feel better, Arnold, you little prick. That's some parenting for you, huh? Feel better about being short, Arnold? Well, meet someone worse than you. Interesting. Okay, we got a couple of two-parter here, which I mentioned earlier. Season 5, Episodes 16 and 17, The Bicycle Man, Parts 1 and 2. These two episodes might just be the greatest hour in television history. Arnold and his pal Dudley befriend the owner of a bicycle shop played by Gordon Jump, unaware that he is a pedophile looking for his next victim. Mm-hmm. The bike shop owner invites them to his back room and shows them porn, offers them wine. It's pretty rough. Arnold splits, tells his pops, and when they return, Dudley is buzzed on Merlot and not wearing a shirt. Yikes. Fun little postscript to that story. A few years later, my mom, in real life, got us involved in the Church of Latter-day Saints, and I was taken to a meeting where they popped in a video of their celebrity spokesperson at the time, Mr. Gordon Jump. I about shit my pants when they popped this video and Gordon Jump pops up, you know. I was just a mess until the wine kicked in, and then I started feeling a lot more at ease with the whole thing. So let's pause for a moment. So I may remind you that Arnold has already been held hostage in a bank, right, and was about 6 seconds away from being raped in a bike shop. Okay, let's continue now. Season 6, Episodes 14 and 15, The Hitchhikers, Parts 1 and 2. Arnold and Kimberly learn the dangers of hitchhiking when they are abducted and held captive by a sinister man. Have these fucking kids picked up any street smarts at all living in New York City? For fuck's sake. Anyway, Arnold escapes, which he tends to do, and he gets the cops so they can come rescue Kimberly. Now, if I wrote this episode, it would have ended with Kimberly buzzed on Merlot with her shirt off. We call that the Dudley in the biz. Oh boy, I'm going to hell for that one. Okay, let's go on with the crazy. Season 6, Episode 17, Hooray for Hollywood, Part 2. The family is in Hollywood where Mr. Drummond proposes to Maggie, and everyone finds out only then that she has a 7-year-old son named Gary Coleman's replacement. Wait, no, his name is Sam. Anyway, Arnold doesn't like new Arnold, I mean Sam, and for some dumb reason, they end up locked inside of the car from Knight Rider, Kit, right? They end up locked inside of Kit, which is about to be blown up as part of a Knight Rider episode. Of course, they escape, but I wish they hadn't. They should have been given the old Dudley, Merlot, and no shirts. Now, let's pause. Let's pause one more time to be reminded that this family has already experienced a hostage situation at a bank, a pedophile abduction, and a hitchhiker abduction. I'm sure nothing like this will ever happen again, though. I'm certain that this family has learned to be more alert. Season 8, Episode 1, Sam's missing. Never mind. They didn't learn anything. They never learn. In this fun-filled hour-long episode, 7-year-old Sam is kidnapped in a grocery store by a grief-stricken man looking to replace his own dead child. Knowing the consequences of his actions, he tells Sam that he will brutally murder his parents if he tries to escape. Mr. Drummond goes on the air to offer a reward, kind of like Mel Gibson did in that movie, wherever the fuck it was. Stolen? Payback? I forget. Anyway, an extortionist gives the Drummonds false hope in this episode. It's a whole thing. A real-life police officer makes an appearance with his dummy, Freddy, to teach kids about stranger danger. I don't know where Freddy's been hiding, because his family deals with an abduction about every 6 or 7 months, so maybe Child Services needs to get involved with this family. Anyway, it ended well. I was, not gonna lie, I was tempted to make another Merlot, like, no shirt Dudley joke, but I held back. I'll use it for a callback later. So let's talk about our next show. That is Different Strokes. Let's talk about another show that featured a famous housekeeper in the form of Nell Carter. Give me a break. So let's take a break from Crazy Town to chat about a show that was merely mildly annoying. Give Me a Break was an NBC sitcom starring, like I said, singer-actor Nell Carter. Lasted 6 seasons from 81 to 87 and aired 137 episodes. The premise is simple. Nell Carter plays Nell Harper, huge stretch there, who promises her dying friend that upon her death, she will give up her singing career to move into her home and work as a live-in housekeeper while also acting as a surrogate mother to her 3 daughters and chambermaid to her police chief husband, Carl. That, my friends, warrants a discussion. A white woman is dying. On her deathbed, she makes her black friend promise to give up on her dream of being a singer to be her family's housekeeper when she dies. Wow. Like, that is some serious white privilege. Being white in the 80s sounds fucking awesome. That's crazy. So, Nell lives with and works for the Kaniski family. The patriarch is Carl. He's the local police chief, played by the man with the biggest head I've ever seen, Dolph Sweet. There are 3 Kaniski daughters, each of whom is a perfect stereotype. Oldest daughter is Katie. Katie has the dual role of being the hot one and the disappointment because she enjoys having sex in high school, dropping out of college, and later dating a married man. Julie is the middle daughter. She's the smart one, with just a hint of disappointment because she gets married at like 18 years old. Sam, the youngest, is a tomboy and annoying and kind of dumb, which I'll explain later. Again, this show isn't as batshit crazy like Different Strokes, but they had some shit in common. Give Me a Break also featured some great guest stars, the Pointer Sisters, Sammy Davis Jr., Whitney Houston, Milton Berle, Don Rickles. It's also the show that gave us, in my opinion, some of the more annoying actors of the 80s and 90s in the form of Joey Lawrence, Thelma Hopkins, and Jonathan Silverman. So let's go on a little tangent about those 3. Joey Lawrence joined the show via the Cousin Oliver strategy that we discussed earlier. We all know Cousin Oliver, right? That's when a show aims, again, to boost the ratings by boosting the cuteness factor and adding a child to the cast. The Brady Bunch made this move famous when they added Cousin Oliver, hence the name. Tons of shows have done it, including our pals at Different Strokes. Well, Joey Lawrence joined the cast in season 3 as an abandoned 7-year-old trying to hustle people out of their money. Nell spotted him, became Aunt Nell, and was later promoted to foster mother Nell. Later, the show would Cousin Oliver the Cousin Oliver by adding Joey's real-life little brother Matthew to the cast as well. It was a daring move, the Cousin Oliver to the Cousin Oliver, but they pulled it off. Now, here's why Joey Lawrence is annoying. First, they were always pushing his singing down our throats, just like Different Strokes did with Sam, okay? I think I speak for everyone when I say, not interested. No one wants to hear that kid sing or watch him tap dance or watch him act on a sitcom. No one's interested. Also, I hate when actors seem to only play characters who share their real name. Joey plays Joey. on damn near every show he's ever worked on until he hit like 35 years old and just demanded to now be called Joe, like Debbie Gibson. She's now Deborah Gibson. No, you're fucking Debbie Gibson. And Joey Lawrence, you're not Joe Lawrence, you're Joey. On Give Me a Break, he's Joey. And to add insult to injury, his brother Matthew plays Matthew. Hell, even Nell plays Nell. It's all kind of troubling. Are they like Homer Simpson? Could they not respond to other names if given another name? 4 episodes after meeting Joey, we meet Nell's new BFF, Addie Wilson, played by the equally annoying Thelma Hopkins. Now, there's a whole thing. Thelma, that's my phone. Look at me, I'm popular. I apologize. Thelma was already kind of famous as being one half of Dawn, as in Tony Orlando and Dawn, the singing group. That said, no one knew her name. She was just that chick from Dawn. Give Me a Break gave her a name and apparently permission to invade my television every week for the rest of my fucking life. Thelma Hopkins has a knack for becoming an unnecessary series regular on tons of shows. Remember her as the aunt in Family Matters? Her sole purpose on that show was to smile like she's on pills and then beat a mom to that little Michael Jackson look like Richie. Ugh, hated that kid. The whole thing irritates me. I don't know why she bugged me so much. I think it was her constant smile. She was always so fucking cheery. And she created some odd storylines that gave me a break because it seemed like there were quite a few episodes of she and Nell fighting over men. Now, at the risk of coming off sexist, I don't see how so many men can be interested in both Thelma Hopkins and Nell Carter. One is just under 6 feet tall and weighs about 96 pounds. The other is Nell Carter. See what I'm saying here? So anyway, then there's Jonathan Silverman. He was to the 80s what Chris O'Donnell was to the 90s. Hollywood really wanted us to like them, and we just didn't give a shit. Every time I offered this Jonathan Silverman diatribe, right? I've done it on Facebook. I've done it in bars. There's always some asshole who wants to remind me of his success in The Single Guy. Yeah, Single Guy. Canceled after 43 episodes. I remember. I was there. When you were the star of a sitcom that aired in the 90s on NBC's must-see TV Thursday night lineup, along with Friends and Seinfeld, at the height of their powers, and that show fails, you really need to leave. Your time is up. Just go away. Anyway, so now that I've vented about that, let's get back to Give Me a Break. Actor Dolph Sweet passed away in 1985, so season 5 began with the family dealing with his loss. Eventually, all 3 daughters were written off the show, and then Nell, Addie, and Joey all moved to New York. This retooling didn't help the ratings much, and the show was eventually canceled after 6 seasons. I always liked Nell Carter. I know I make jokes. I always liked Nell Carter. I really enjoyed her singing voice. She struggled throughout the run of the show with drugs and alcohol, went to rehab several times. She ultimately passed away really young in 2003. She was only 54 years old. Yet, Thelma Hopkins is still out there smiling like a lunatic. We couldn't take her, God. We had to take Nell. Oh, boy. So let's break down, though, the portrayal of the housekeepers on Give Me a Break. Or housekeeper on Give Me a Break. Did it make sense that the Kaniskis had a full-time live-in housekeeper? Absolutely. First, he's the police chief, so I'm guessing he makes good bread and can afford to house Nell Carter. Feeding her, on the other hand, that might be... Housing her is one thing. Feeding her, I don't know. That was a bad joke. All right. Second, he has 3 daughters and needs all the help he can get. Even with Nell there, there's still all kinds of premarital teen sex happening. Imagine the orgies that would have been going on without her. So I think they needed Nell. Did the housekeeper take too many liberties? No. Those liberties needed to be taken or else those girls would have all ended up hopped up on pills and pregnant. I swear to God. The dear old dad was ill-equipped to deal with the trauma of them losing their mom. Nell pretty much saved the day, basically. Was she a surrogate parent? Yes. But to be fair, she had to be, right? She promised a dying lady that she would take care of her kids after she passed. Nell would have faced an eternity in hell as she's walked away. It's in the Bible. I've read it. It's in the book of Nell. Did she do a good job? Cleaning? Maybe not so much, but she killed it with the rest of her duties. I have to say, I am a fan of old Nell. So final grade, I give her an A. Well done. Now, it's time to take a look at some of my favorite episodes, although they were nowhere near the level of crazy, very special episodes of Different Strokes. They still like to splash in a pinch of crazy every now and then. So let's take a look. S1, E7. Your prisoner is dead. Carl, remember, he's a police chief, happens to be in a drugstore during a robbery. Caught in a standoff, Carl ends up shooting the robber. Now, this might not sound too crazy now, but we're going to circle back to this a little bit later, I promise you. Season 1, Episode 12, The Emergency. Oldest daughter, Katie, is hospitalized due to complications caused by her IUD. Mm-hmm. Now, how's that for family programming? Use birth control, kiddos, but be aware that it can kill you, so... I don't know. I don't know what they're trying to teach us there. S1, E17, Sam's affair. Youngest daughter Sam believes that an innocent kiss from a boy got her pregnant. I remember this. I remember her lying on the floor of her bedroom crying in fear that she was pregnant. Even as a kid, though, I knew something was off. Let's break this down. First, Sam at this point is about 14 years old. Is she fucking stupid? Has no one talked to her about sex? She has two older sisters. One of them clearly requires an IUD, so you know there's some fucking going on, right? How about at school, though? Little boys can't go more than 5 minutes without talking about nasty shit. Sadly, my own daughters were hearing about boners and 69ing by the time they were in the sixth grade. So we're going to circle back on Sam here in a minute because something's off, okay? So let's pause like we did last time. Let's take a brief moment to recap some things. There's already been a shooting on the show, which is pretty dramatic. We've also learned that Sam might be special. Okay, let's continue. S2 E9, Sam faces death. Carl is accidentally shot in the hand by one of his police officers. The injuries are minor, but youngest daughter Sam is worried he will die. Let's let that sink in. Another shooting. And another reason to ask, is Sam really innocent? Or is maybe Sam retarded? Is Sam retarded? I think Sam might be retarded. Either way, the show is starting to dip its toe into the crazy end of the pool. Mm-hmm. Let's continue. Season 4, Episode 6, Whodunit. Nell and Ray Parker. Ray Parker Jr. Yes, that Ray Parker Jr. Nell and Ray Parker Jr. Stumble upon a man lying on the street, not breathing. Rather than save his life, they instead decide to argue over the proper way to administer CPR. Of course, the man dies while these two jackasses are arguing. To make themselves feel better, I guess, they plan a memorial for him during which Ray Parker Jr. will perform for the deceased man's widow, not knowing that the deceased man was a vicious mobster known as Eddie the Enforcer. My favorite part of this episode is how starstruck everyone gets when they realize they're talking to Ray Parker Jr. I honestly wonder if Ray ever watches this episode and cries. Like, what happened in my life? For those of you who don't know, and I'm guessing many of you don't, Ray Parker Jr. famously sang the Ghostbusters theme song. That was his moment in the sun. He eventually got sued by Huey Lewis in the news because it sounded too much like one of his songs. He lost that lawsuit, so Huey Lewis got all this money. But even at the height of this fame, I can't imagine people recognize Ray Parker Jr. outside. Like, if you didn't see him wearing a Ghostbusters uniform in that video, you wouldn't know who the fuck he was. Anyway, I just love it. Mobster, dead guy, Ray Parker Jr. Like, what the fuck is going on? All right, let's move on. S4, E11, baby of the family. Remember Sam? Mm-hmm. Sam is angry because Nell... Oh, this is a good one. Oh, I remember what this is now. Sam is angry because Nell wouldn't let her go on a co-ed camping trip. To make matters worse, she feels that Nell favors 7-year-old Joey over her, which she did, by the way. Seeking revenge on both Nell and Joey, Sam, quote-unquote, helps Joey plan a song to perform at Nell's church. And by helps, I mean she had him do a blackface performance for Nell at her church. Yep. Blackface. That's some cold shit. It's a good thing that no one gives a shit about Joey Lawrence anymore because he would be at risk of being canceled if he were still kind of relevant. Sometimes it's good, kiddos, to just fade away rather than get canceled. All right. Blackface is rough. But at least this family isn't having to deal with shootings anymore, right? Am I right, guys? No more shootings? S5, E7, the gun. Oops. Did the title give it away? While playing with a gun, Joey accidentally shoots Nell in the foot. Okay, line in the sand time. Can we please remove all the guns from this home? 3 shootings in 5 seasons. This show loves shooting guns the way that Different Strokes loved abducting kids. Now, the final show I'm going to talk about today before we wrap up this episode is one of my faves, one of the most famous housekeepers in television history, Mr. Belvedere. Mr. Belvedere premiered on March 15th, 1985 as a mid-season replacement. Gave us 118 episodes over 6 seasons. It was a part of ABC's Friday night lineup until it was moved to Saturdays for its final season. Saturdays, as you know, that's where television shows go to die, and old Mr. Belvedere was eventually canceled in 1990. Incidentally, though, 1989 is when ABC created its first of many TGIF lineups, so Mr. Belvedere just missed out on being part of the TGIF family. That sucks. I'm guessing that that the Mr. B cast is never invited to any of the TGIF reunions to rub shoulders and enjoy hors d'oeuvres with the likes of Jaleel White and Mark Lynn Baker. Oh well, such is the glamour of TV life. Like the other shows we've discussed so far today, the premise of Mr. Belvedere is simple. The parents of three children are spread thin and struggling to maintain order in the household, so they bring in a hired gun. In this case, the hired gun is a middle-aged Brit, Lynn Belvedere, whose former employers include Winston Churchill and the royal family. We'll get back to that in a moment. The parents in this case are sports journalist George Owens, played by one of the most annoying, ubiquitous C-listers of the 80s, Bob Uecker, and his wife Marcia, who was recently enrolled in law school, and she was played by Eileen Graff. They're seemingly a middle-class family living in Pittsburgh, raising their three kids. The three kids are as follows: Kevin, the oldest and pretty forgettable; Heather, the middle child, also pretty forgettable; Wesley, the youngest, he's a smart-ass troublemaker and essentially the second lead of the show behind Mr. Belvedere. So let's unpack a few things here. First, how can this family afford a full-time live-in housekeeper whose responsibilities include cooking, cleaning, and raising the children? I mean, again, this is a middle-class family living in a suburb of Pittsburgh. Realistically, right, they're hiring someone to come in and clean once a week, maybe do some shopping and or meal prep. That's it. And by the way, this is going to be like an under-the-table, all-cash deal involving someone who's likely stealing the loose change found in the sofa cushions. That's all the old Owens checking account can handle, in my estimation. So how is it that they end up hiring this overqualified, highly experienced, pristinely well-mannered butler to come live with them? And not just live with them, he takes over every household duty short of fucking Marcia, which I'm guessing isn't Mr. Belvedere's cup of tea, so to speak. So I'm calling bullshit on this whole premise. Unrelated, let's talk about sports writers for a second. Is it me, or do television writers have absolutely zero respect for sports writers? Why am I expected to believe that George Owens is a writer of any kind? This guy is a shit for brains of the highest order. I know very little, admittedly. Admittedly, I know very little about the world of sports journalism, but I assume it involves the daily study of what's going on in sports, daily scores, trades, injuries, etc. Then that needs to be like woven into a commentary full of educated opinions and then input into a daily article or television report and then sent out to the masses. The Owens family patriarch is basically a fucking gorilla, and we never see him doing any of that stuff. Bob Uecker is a former baseball player, so we're just asked to accept that being a former mediocre athlete easily translates to journalism? Everybody Loves Raymond did the same shit with Ray Romano's character, by the way. That guy was like bordering on retarded. He never cracked a book, but he has a daily New York Newsday column? Get the fuck out of here. I'm calling bullshit. All right, rant over. Back to Mr. Belvedere. Christopher Hewitt, as Lynn Belvedere, along again with Bryce Beckham as the youngest son, Wesley, basically they carried the show. Mr. Hewitt was a prominent stage actor and director and had a pretty limited resume, film resume anyway, prior to landing the show. The bulk of his television work came in the form of 22 episodes of Fantasy Island. He played Mr. Rourke's sidekick, Lawrence, after they fired the previous sidekick, Tattoo, which was portrayed very famously by Hervé Villechaize. Da plane, that guy. He got fired and they brought in a whole new character. Not much is known about Christopher Hewitt's personal life. He was a lifelong bachelor. So I'll let you interpret that however you like. He was also the subject of a very famous urban legend. Okay, we got to talk about this. I've heard this story several times. You can look it up. It's often credited to different folks. More often than not, though, it gets credited to Adam Sandler. So let's just run with that. According to lore, Sandler was guesting on Mr. Belvedere during his pre-SNL acting days. During that episode's table read, Christopher Hewitt showed up in a jogging suit and he plopped down in a chair. A loud scream filled the room and Christopher Hewitt was like doubled over in pain. Apparently, he had plopped down on one of his testicles and had to be carted off to the hospital. This is a real thing. You can Google it. He apparently sat on his own ball, had to go to the hospital. Meanwhile, a young Adam Sandler sitting there probably shitting his pants with laughter. and that is the urban legend of Mr. Belvedere and his balls. Ultimately, though, Mr. Belvedere was a sweet, likable show. It's, you know, it's a fish out of water formula with the uptight, proper Mr. Belvedere was clashing with dumb American Owens family, right? His main antagonist often comes in the form of youngest child Wesley, who may or may not be a sociopath. I'm not really sure. In the end, Lynn Belvedere is a surrogate parent and a far better influence than his real dad, who you've probably noticed irritates the shit out of me. Each episode ended with Mr. Belvedere in his bedroom rubbing one out. Kidding about that. But he did end in his bedroom. He's always in his bedroom writing in his journal and recapping that episode's events and the lessons that were learned. The series eventually ended with Lynn marrying a woman and moving to Africa with her. I have to admit, I did not see any of that coming. So that's how it ended. Like other shows, Mr. Belvedere certainly enjoyed its very special episodes. As we've seen, Different Strokes enjoyed abductions, while Give Me a Break was more of a let's shoot someone kind of a sitcom. Mr. Belvedere's brand of crazy often came in the form of sexual misbehavior. Mom Marcia had a workplace sexual harassment episode. Her husband George had a workplace sexual harassment episode. There was like a Bring an Ugly Girl to a Party episode. The kids in various episodes dated people of inappropriate ages. There was a famous molestation episode. And even an episode in which the oldest son, Kevin, started working as an escort. I'm not making that up. So it was all easy to wash down, though, with some hot English tea in the form of Mr. Belvedere, right? So let's review the housekeeping before we talk about some episodes. So the housekeeping. Did it make sense that the Owens had a full-time live-in housekeeper? No. They had one income in the form of the imbecile dad's writing career. And I get that the mom was back in school. I get that. But was it an 8-hour-a-day school situation? Was there really no time for her to run a vacuum across the living room or maybe cook a fucking meatloaf? I don't know. Did the housekeeper take too many liberties? Yes. He raised Wesley, but in hindsight, I think it was for the best. The parents were useless on this show. Was he a surrogate parent? Yes. And he likely kept Wesley out of prison. Did he do a good job? My man killed it. Best butler in Pittsburgh. So my final grade for Mr. Belvedere, I'm giving him an A as well. Interested in some of my favorite nutty episodes, you say? Well, here you go. This show had its own brand of nuttiness. Like I said, let's take a look at them. Season 2, Episode 15, Rivals. This one is called Rivals. Middle child Heather. Oh, this is great. This is so fucking great. Okay. Middle child Heather has a new boyfriend named Sean, played by a young, extra smarmy Jason Bateman, by the way. Sean clearly prefers MILFs and puts the move on Heather's mom, Marcia. It's actually pretty fucked up. He purposely walks in on Marcia while she's changing and then refuses to leave her bedroom. She tells him to go home and take a cold shower. This happened. Pointed to the master bathroom, young Jason Bateman says, "What's wrong with the one right in there?" So she says, "Go home, take a cold shower." He points at the master bathroom, suggesting he uses that shower. That's some gangster shit coming from a 15-year-old. Marcia eventually relents and allows him to shower with her on the condition that he allow Heather to join them. I think I might have imagined that last part. Did he shower with the mom and then the daughter joined him? I can't. Did that happen? Did I make that? Let's just go with it. Let's say that happened. It would be a better show if it had. But that's the first crazy episode. Okay. The very next episode that aired was season 2, episode 16, Wesley's Friend. Okay. If there was a Mount Rushmore of 80s very special episodes, this little gem would be right up there next to the shirtless Dudley in the bicycle shop. The premise is simple. Wesley's school chum gets AIDS via a blood transfusion and gets pulled out of school. Believing all the rumors he's heard about their various ways to catch AIDS, Wesley becomes scared of his friend and turns his back on him just like everyone else. Luckily, Mr. Belvedere magically knows everything about everything and he kind of steps in to educate everyone about AIDS. It's a happy ending for everyone. I mean, except for the kid with AIDS. I'm guessing he later died. but everyone else had a happy ending. The reason that this episode will live forever in infamy is because of one little scene involving the kid with AIDS. I think his name was Danny. Early in the episode, the kid rings the doorbell, and he's welcomed into the Owens' living room. When asked how he's doing, he cheerfully responds with, "Well, I got AIDS, but other than that, I'm doing pretty good." It's absolutely fucking insane. You can Google that. Google Mr. Belvedere, kid with AIDS, and I promise you what's going to pop up is this little nasally kid with glasses walking in and going, "Well, pretty good, except for I have AIDS." Oh boy. Season 3, episode 3. This one's called Debut. I'm not going to add commentary to this. I just think it's a fantastic synopsis, and here it goes. after Mr. Belvedere saves George from nearly getting himself killed by electrocution when his TV falls into the bathtub, George decides to quit his job as a sports writer and become a lounge singer. However, Mr. Belvedere feels that George is making a big mistake, so he asks for the help of Robert Goulet to discourage George, but not before George makes his singing debut at the Steel Town Inn. You can't see me, but I'm rubbing my eyes. Like, what's going on here? By the way, if you don't know, Robert Goulet was a lounge singer, pretty much C-level. He appeared in, I think, one of those Naked Gun movies. And actually, he had more than one occurrence on Mr. Belvedere. I don't know what the relationship was, but Robert Goulet often appeared on Mr. Belvedere. But that premise is one of my favorites. After Mr. Belvedere saves George from nearly getting himself killed by electrocution, when his TV falls into the bathtub, George decides to quit his job as a sports writer and become a lounge singer. However, Mr. Belvedere feels that George is making a big mistake, so he asks for the help of Robert Goulet to discourage him. Oh my lord, that is some awful shit. All right, come more. Season 3, episodes 6 and 7, Deportation, parts 1 and 2. Angry that Mr. Belvedere ratted him out to his parents about cheating on a history test, Wesley gets Mr. Belvedere deported. Like, for real. Deported out of the country. That's some cold shit. Season 3, episode 10, Pills. Marcia gets hooked on diet pills when using them to stay awake for studying, just like Alex P. Keaton did on Family Ties. Season 3, episode 18, Kevin's older woman. Kevin loses his virginity to an older woman, just like Alex P. Keaton did on Family Ties. They keep ripping off Family Ties. S4, E9. Oh, this is a fun one. G.I. George, this is called. S4, E9. G.I. George. Having always been wowed by his dad's tales of fighting in the Korean War, Wesley invites his old man to be a guest speaker in his history class. But guess what, kiddos? It turns out George Owens is full of shit and was too young to be in the Korean War. It was all stolen valor bullshit. Wesley, like the rest of us, goes back to seeing his dad as just a disappointing loser. But wow, stolen valor. Imagine telling your kid his whole life that you fought in the Korean War, and you have to look him in the eyes and say, I'm a liar. I never went to war. Oh boy. I should probably stop telling my kids that I fought in war. All right, S4, episode 20, The Counselor. Oh boy, oh boy. This episode's another Mount Rushmore candidate. While at summer camp, Wesley is touched inappropriately by a camp counselor he trusted. He has a difficult time telling anyone until he fears it may happen to another kid at the camp. The storyline was actually taken from a discarded script for Meatballs 5. That was a bad joke. That was a stupid joke. Anyway, what makes this episode special, I can't describe it, again, Google it, is they show some of the molestation. They show the counselor like drying Wesley off with a towel and then rubbing his bare shoulders. It's fucking horrific. But anyway, it would probably end up on the Mount Rushmore. Very, very special episodes. S5, E22, Almost Heaven. Wesley is grounded, but he sneaks out. Since the parents are apparently fucking useless, Mr. Belvedere hops in the car to hunt him down, only to get into an accident and end up in a coma. Wesley, of course, is stricken with grief. An angel appears to Mr. Belvedere to show him, and I'm not making this up, that the Owens family will be fine without him. It's a total reverse on the whole It's a Wonderful Life storyline, because I thought angels were supposed to appear and show you how shitty things would be without you. Not in this case. This case, angels are like, no, it's the family's fine. Follow the light if you need to. The family will be fine. So I guess, Mr. Belvedere, your life is pointless. So, oh well. Season 6, episode 18, Bad Marcia. Marcia, I'm going to have to read this with a straight face. Marcia, now a lawyer, goes into a prison to meet a client she is supposed to defend. However, they look almost completely identical, so the criminal knocks her out and assumes her identity to escape from prison, leaving Marcia to figure things out in the clink. I'm not making any of this up. Congratulations to the folks behind the show, Mr. Belvedere. You have done it. You have successfully jumped the shark. Identical people, a prison escape. Just under the wire. Just under the wire, you guys jumped the shark. And then finally, there's a season 6, episode 23, the finale. Remembering that Wesley both had him deported and caused him to be in a coma, Mr. Belvedere calls his buddy who owns a bicycle shop, and together they give Wesley the Dudley. Boom! Called it back, just like I said I would. And that wraps up Season 5, Episode 6. That is Keeping House Part 1. Tune in next week when I take a look at some other housekeeping shows, ones that did it horribly, like Who's the Boss? Charles in Charge. Oh, man, it's going to be amazing. If you like the podcast, if you like your boy Fanacek, please like the show, review the show, email me. I am FanacekPodcast@gmail.com. Hit me up on Twitter @FanacekPodcast. The best way to hit me up is on Facebook. I am Real Fanacek. Go to my YouTube channel. I've interviewed some celebrities over the year, not to name drop, but I've done some celebrity interviewing. You can see that on my YouTube channel. Just look up Fanacek on YouTube. And again, this is going to be Season 5. It's going to be all about the 80s. So I hope you enjoy it. And here's what I really need you to do. I need you to just relax. Relax, take a deep breath. And stay tuned for the next exciting episode of Fanacek.